TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Safe Food Movement versus Agrochemical Giants, Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, Syngenta, and more. Campaigns for labeling genetically engineered food have swept the U.S. from California to Washington and on to Connecticut, Maine, and Alaska, Oregon, and Vermont. Actually, by January 2014, according to the Center for Food Safety, 26 states had introduced mandatory labeling legislation. People who participated in these campaigns realized with surprise and shock that they were fighting for a right that is already guaranteed in 64 other countries, including all the industrial democracies that we compare ourselves to. The other shocking discovery was that such a simple and obvious demand, the right to know what food we put into our bodies, was challenged wherever it was about to be codified via ballot proposals or state legislation by a powerful and extremely well-funded lobby. Foremost among them, of course, the agrochemical corporations, such as Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, Syngenta, Bayer, BASF, and junk food manufacturers such as Kraft Foods, PepsiCo, and Coca-Cola. It was their money that led to narrow defeats of Truth in Labeling in California and Washington State. Now, at the beginning of the year 2014, these corporations and their lobbyists in Washington and their trade associations, among them the Grocery Manufacturers Association, have moved their campaigns up by a huge quantitative leap. Instead of fighting pro-labeling in legislation state by state, they're formulating legislation at the federal level, outlawing any state's right to label GMOs. Simultaneously, an international trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that is currently being negotiated, apparently includes language written by biotech corporations outlawing GMO labelings for all 11 member states of the TPP. That includes the US, Canada, Mexico, China, Australia, New Zealand, Chile, and Japan. Why, one wonders, is the addition of a dozen letters on a food package contains GMOs worth millions of dollars to influence the vote, more millions to buy off members of Congress to ban labeling across the U.S., and even to ban labeling under international trade for most of the world's population? And what does the secrecy have to do with the efforts by Dow Chemical Corporation, culminating in the first weeks of 2014, to introduce new corn and soy seeds that are genetically engineered to be sprayed with 2,4-D? That's a component of the infamous Agent Orange. By February 13 of 2014, the Center for Food Safety expanded their campaign to stop Dow Chemical's Agent Orange crops, to influence the approval process before the USDA. During the war in Vietnam, the United States used Agent Orange as a chemical defoliant. It caused both lasting environmental damage in Southeast Asia and birth defects and medical problems for the people of Vietnam and for veterans. Now Dow Chemical wants approval to use 2,4-D on American ag land and food. Vandana Shiva and Andy Kimball, who have dedicated their lives to alerting us to the danger of genetic engineering, came to California in the fall of 2013. Their goal was to explain the hidden history of the corporate experimentation with life. Shiva and Kimbrell are also among the few people who deeply understand the extraordinary expansion of ownership and patent rights to life, seeds, and even the smallest building blocks of life, DNA, genes, and cell lines. Vandana Shiva trained in quantum physics and became a seed saver and ecologist in 1982. She and her organization, Navdanya, resist the spread of GMOs into India. For Vandana Shiva, the imposition of GMOs is a war on life and the most recent wave of colonialism against her home country, India. She learned from Gandhi. As he chose the spinning wheel, Navdanya chose the seed and dedicated themselves to its protection. Navdanya is a network of seed keepers and organic producers spread across 17 states in India and has helped set up 111 community seed banks across the country. They also train farmers in sustainable agriculture and helped set up the largest direct marketing organic network in India. When I first met Andy Kimbrell, he was senior attorney and policy director for the Foundation for Economic Trends in Washington, D.C. 16 years ago, he founded the Center for Food Safety and is their executive director. On their extraordinary website, you can find near daily updates and action proposals on genetic engineering of food, as well as fish, animals, insects, trees, and seeds. And then there are larger topics, such as pollinators and pesticides, with info on bees and monarch butterflies. The section on food safety has chapters on RBGH, mad cow disease, factory farms, and more. Andy Kimbrell is a public interest attorney, and we owe it to him and his interventions up to the Supreme Court that we're not already eating salmon inserted with growth hormones or tomatoes inserted with fish genes. He helped convince McDonald's not to use genetically engineered potatoes and won in the courts the ban on genetic engineered wheat. Kimbrell and the Center for Food Safety have been instrumental in stopping GE alfalfa for 8 years and are back in the courts on it now. After having stopped GE salmon for 13 years, they're ready to go to court if final approval is granted now in 2014. Vandana Shiva and Andy Kimbrell spoke at a panel at the Heirloom Seed Expo in Santa Rosa, California, in September 2013. Kimbrell was asked to define genetic engineering, and you will notice in a moment that there was a serious problem with the sound. My recording equipment was plugged into their PA system, and I was unable to affect the outcome. So here are just a few words by Andy Kimbrell to give you a sense of his personality and energy, and the rest is my transcript of what he said. Andy Kimbrell.
The best way to describe genetic engineering is cell invasion technology. The idea is that you have a natural cell and a plant, and you want to get foreign DNA into that cell that never was there before and doesn't belong there.
Andy Kimbrell continued. For example, you're trying to put a flounder gene into a tomato, which they have done. It was the so-called flavor-saver tomato. So how in the heck do you do that? You take the flounder gene and attach it to bacteria or virus. Why do you use a bacteria or virus? Because bacteria and virus are very good at invading cells. Everybody out there who has a cold, or God forbid a flu, knows that's exactly what is happening to you right now. So they find an agrobacterium they use for plants and a virus that they use for animals. They attach that gene, that novel gene, and that invades the cell. They usually attach to that what they call the cauliflower mosaic virus, which they call the turn-on gene, which promotes the activity of that new gene in the nucleus, in the cell, where it does not belong. Think of it a little bit like putting an organ into a human being. The body wants to reject the organ. That's what the cell wants to do with a novel gene. The cauliflower mosaic virus is trying to stop that rejection. So you have the vector that invades the cell, and then you have the genetic material you want to drop off, let's say the flounder gene into the tomato, or the herbicide-tolerant gene into corn or soy. And then at the end, they put a so-called antibiotic marker, which is usually ampicillin or neomycin, to see if the genetic material really made it in there. That is cell invasion, how you get a foreign gene into the cell of an organism where it does not belong. And they're using one other technique, which is called ballistics. They take the novel genes they want, they put it in a plasmid DNA coding, and they literally shoot it in, like a tiny shotgun or gene gun, right into the cell. When the biotechnology companies say this is just like beer or yeast, that's absolutely wrong. These are novel vectors, novel viruses, novel genes. They have never been in these foods before. Cell invasion technology is probably the best term. That was a transcript of a comment by Andy Kimbrell, public interest attorney, author, and executive director of the Center for Food Safety. He spoke on a panel at the 2013 Heirloom Seed Expo, moderated by Dan Imhoff. Imhoff is an author, musician, and artisan food producer. He has written for 20 years on topics related to ecological sustainability. He's the author of numerous articles, essays, and books, including Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to the Next Food and Farm Bill. Imhoff asked Andy Kimbrell how permanent these genetic constructs are. How confident are they that after inserting the gene, it will consistently stay there? This answer by Andy Kimbrell was slightly better in sound quality.
Well, as you can imagine, this is a very imprecise technology, right? So you've got the bacteria vector and it's dropping off the gene in the new organism. Let's say that flounder gene in the tomato. It doesn't know where in the genome it's going to go. I mean, for example, they just did the genome of wheat, and wheat has 80,000 genes. We have about 20,000. So if you add the genes of four major Nobel Prize winners, Watson, Crick, Berg, and Borlaug would say, it doesn't quite equal that of wheat. I'm not making this up. So you can imagine how complicated that wheat is. Pinot Noir has 40,000, by the way, for those of us. It's a very complicated grape and more complicated than many of the people I work with in Congress, so it makes sense. It makes sense we have twice as many genes as certain people in the House of Representatives today. But nevertheless, it's a very complicated thing. So when the bacteria vector drops off that gene, it doesn't do it in a precise place. When Monsanto and the boys tell you, oh, this is very precise, it's the least precise technology you can imagine. They have no idea where it's going. So they have 99.8%, 99% failure rate. They have no idea where it's going to go. Now imagine that shotgun. They're just shooting it into the genome, shooting into those chromosomes. Wherever it lands, that's where it lands. So their failure rate is 98%, 99% all the time. And then when they get something that somehow gets somewhere near where they want, that's when they start using that and then breeding that particular cell tissue in that particular seed. Now once it's in there, unfortunately, then of course it becomes part of natural reproduction and then it stays there. But it mutates, it changes. Obviously this is a living thing, not a machine. And so the idea of what that will become, how that DNA will interact with all the other DNA, with the RNA, with the millions of epigenetic markers in that cell over a period of time, in that organism over a period of time, is unknown. So we have an imprecise technology which leads to almost 99% failure most of the time, and even when they quote succeed, it is literally built to have unknowable changes in the future. That's the technology we're talking about.
Andy Kimbrell, Executive Director of the Center for Food Safety. Dan Imhoff then turned to Vandana Shiva and asked her to explain pesticides embedded in plants and herbicide tolerance and how it fits into GMO agriculture. Vandana Shiva from India is trained in quantum physics and became a seed saver and ecologist in 1982. Shiva started with a class of plants that have pesticide engineered into the seed, the Bacillus thuringiensis. These so-called BT crops, such as BT corn or BT soy, actually express the pesticide in each of their cells, in stem, leaves, roots, fruit, and pollen. When a caterpillar eats a leaf or a monarch butterfly ingests the pollen, they die or are seriously harmed. Of course, humans or farm animals also ingest a dose of the pesticide when they eat the corn cobs or plant material or any soy products. Here's Vandana Shiva explaining how the embedded pesticide acts on butterflies and soil organisms.
Every cell is producing it. That's why butterflies are dying, the Cornell study. Soil organisms are dying, our Navdanya study in India. That's why animals died, 1,600. And when the autopsies were done, they had grazed in the BT cotton fields. Their digestive tract was black, like it had been poisoned. Second category is herbicide-resistant or herbicide-tolerant crops. Basically, the company sells the herbicide. Once they've sold too much of it, there's a buildup of the toxin in the soil. A Roundup, for example, kills everything green it comes in contact with. So the productivity starts to decline. Then they come up with genes in the plant that allow the plant to resist the spray. And the argument is this is controlled weeds. Instead, as I mentioned last night, 70 million acres in the United States are overtaken by superweeds. And Monsanto is recommending use Agent Orange because Roundup is failing. And they're now getting ready, DuPont has an application for an Agent Orange resistant plant. Two things about this. First, they always talk of productivity. The individual plant gets its yield not from genetic engineering, the shooting of the genes, of toxic genes. It gets its yield from the original plant material. So genetic engineering has nothing to do with yields. That's one of the first lies they tell. If you bred a conventional crop, that's the yield. But second, in our kinds of situations in the third world or in gardens, we grow a lot of plants. And the use of Roundup-resistant crops means you destroy food. That's why the technical expert committee to the Supreme Court of India said in a society like India with tiny farms and biodiversity, Roundup-resistant crops have no place at all. They have a place anywhere, but in country like, you know, Argentina, they've absolutely handed over to large tracts of Roundup ready soya. The Midwest of this country is empty of farmers and full of Roundup. Studies have been done that show that the soil sprayed with Roundup loses beneficial organisms and starts to create pathogenic organisms, which is why you're getting these huge epidemics of animal stillbirths and abortions because of the toxics in the new emergent bacteria. One of the things, you know, I call them the shooters of genes, don't understand, is that every level there's an ecological balance within the organism, between in the soil, between the organism and the soil, in the agroecosystem. And they are totally killing that organism, which is fine for them. Because nature benefits with that balance. Farmers benefit because a balance creates possibilities to work with nature and produce more. But these corporations have nothing to lose. I woke up to this in 1984 I was traveling to Ethiopia, and the person next to me was from Pioneer, which is now owned by DuPont. He asked me why I'm going. I said, to study the famine for the United Nations. I said, why are you going? He says, to sell hybrid seeds. But I said, they have a drought. He says, yeah, the more it fails, the more we sell. So the more GMOs fail, the more the market. First, for GMOs itself, the farmers of India who are locked in debt, they are buying failed seeds again and again and again, which means failure is an expansion of the market. It's first in the seed, then in the pharmaceuticals, in the agrochemicals, more lethal toxins. So at every level, every destruction, every failure becomes a new opportunity for the corporations, but a loss for people and loss for nature at every level. Which is why I am just so glad that the movement in California is so strong. But I believe it's not just California that needs to secede from this rotten system. The whole world needs to secede from it.
So it seems like herbicide tolerance is really a business plan, because you know that the resistance is going to happen. The weeds are going to develop the resistance. They're putting so much chemicals out there. The strong weeds are going to become super weeds. They're going to have different chemicals. And unfortunately, the different chemicals that they're now moving toward are the stronger, older classes of chemicals since they started with Roundup. And these traits are being stacked. So instead of Roundup Ready, now you're going to have 2,4-D Roundup BT. They're putting all of these herbicide tolerant and insecticide containing traits in the same plant. But I'm wondering, Andy, can you tell us, just if we went back a little bit, we go back to the mid-90s when these plants are being considered. How did the plants become permissible to be grown? What are the main agencies that made the decisions to unleash GMOs on American agriculture?
That last voice was Dan Imhoff, and before him, Vandana Shiva. Among the new class of embedded herbicides that Imhoff is referring to is the one by Dow Chemical Corporation for corn and soy seed that are genetically engineered to survive being sprayed with 2,4-D, a component of the infamous Agent Orange. This so-called Agent Orange crop is in the approval process before the USDA at the time of this recording in February 2014. Now, Andy Kimbrell's answer to Dan Imhoff's question, how back in the mid-90s these plants were permitted in the US, was not properly recorded in the PA system. But here's my transcript. Andy said that, quote, in the 1980s, Al Gore, Robert Kastenmeier, and Max Baucus were among the legislators who wanted to pass legislation requiring mandatory safety testing, environmental testing, and labeling of GMOs. Because of the strength of the biotech industry at that time, all those were defeated. So, we are the only country among all our trading partners where there is not a single law passed by Congress on the environmental, health, or labeling transparency of GMOs. Not one. So all decisions about biotechnology went down into the agencies. For example, the FDA is looking at genetically engineered salmon that is currently up for approval. And if it gets approved, we, meaning Andy Kimbrell and the Center for Food Safety, we will sue the FDA. But the point here is that salmon is defined as a drug, an animal drug. And now in the recording, the sound is improving. So here's the rest of the statement in Andy Kimbrell's own voice.
How can a salmon be an animal drug? Well, because Congress failed to pass any legislation on genetic engineering, the agencies are trying to use whatever legislation they have to try and fit it in there. So FDA said, gee, genetically engineered salmon, well, we'll call it an animal drug. And we'll approve it as an animal drug, which is what they're trying to do. Now, of course, you don't have any environmental testing with an animal drug. And by the way, there's no transparency with an animal drug. The same thing with the BT thing that Vandana was talking about. EPA said, well, what are we going to do? We're supposed to be regulating BT. We have no congressional authority, no statute. Congress failed to do anything. So we'll call BT plants whole plant pesticides. And we will approve all these BT plants as pesticides under FIFRA, which is our law on pesticides. Are you kidding me? I mean, obviously, when they passed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, they didn't think that salmon would be a drug. Obviously, when they passed our pesticide law, they didn't think entire corn plants were going to be a pesticide. So this is the kind of jerry-rigging that's going on, which is why the litigation that we've been doing all these years is trying to force that out and trying to actually get some responsible regulation. But the real problem has been that we do not have a single piece of legislation. All of this went to the agency level, which is not transparent for most people. Raise your hand if you read the Federal Register on a daily basis. Okay, point proven. But it's not transparent, so guess what they did? They began to take all of their, a lot of the people that were doing their science and put them into the federal agencies. They took a lot of their lawyers and put them into the FDA, their scientists in the EPA, USDA, so we have this huge revolving door. Huge revolving door. And right now, the five major biotechnology companies have 116 lobbyists, by the way, 112 of whom either were in Congress or were in the agencies. That's who's lobbying for biotech right now. And then they're going to cycle right back. So they knew that they had easy pickings inside these agencies to push their agenda. So it's a complete failure by our Congress and state legislations, and then a regulatory tangle and a rather corrupt regulatory tangle at these agencies were trying to apply laws that didn't really apply to this technology. That is the unholy marriage, unfortunately, of how we got where we are right now.
That was Andy Kimbrell. He was on a panel with Vandana Shiva from India at the 2013 Heirloom Seed Expo in Santa Rosa, California. Moderator was Dan Imhoff. Come back for the conclusion of this program when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. You can get information on how to order a CD at cost of the one-hour program on The Safe Food Movement versus Agrochemical Giants by calling 1-707-463-2654. You can also place an order on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org or 707-463-2654 for more information. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.